You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, after the fall of Palmyra and fears that Islamic State have seized the last Syrian-controlled crossing between that country and Iraq, we'll ask if the US should change its strategy and where President Assad has got to. Also ahead, David Cameron addresses European leaders in Riga.
Britain is not happy. I'm not happy with the concept of ever closer union. It's not really what we joined or signed up for. So let's sort that out.
We'll be discussing the British Prime Minister's bid to reform his country's ties with the EU. And on a semi-related subject, when to hold a referendum. As Ireland votes on same-sex marriage, we'll discuss the benefits and drawbacks of direct democracy. And we'll mull over a new, no really, Nazi-themed reality show in the Czech Republic. Bad taste, entertainment, or somewhere between the two. That's all coming up in the next 30 minutes on Midori House on Monocle 24. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Jane Kinnan-Mont, Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist at The Times here in the UK. Welcome both. We will start with Islamic State, and their conquest of Syria's World Heritage-listed Roman ruin Palmyra has dominated Middle Eastern headlines over the last day or two, and quite rightly. A smaller story, possibly at least as significant, is their seizure of the last government-controlled border between Syria and Iraq, which means that to the extent that that border still means anything at all, Islamic State is defining what it means. Jane, I'll ask you exactly that question first. Does that border, the one that separates Iraq and Syria, actually mean anything anymore?
Yes, it does. I think the Islamic State are trying to blur the border. The conflicts are linked, but there are some different issues at play in Iraq and Syria. There is still a different sense of national identity among many people, many of the Arabs in each of the countries. And the conflict is very different because in Iraq, you're having international cooperation with a government fighting Islamic State. And in Syria, you have basically the opposite. So militarily, the conflicts in each place are very different.
To take that question a step further, Michael, should the rest of the world stop acting as if that border means anything? Because there are separate frameworks in terms of the airstrikes being run by the coalition. There are some coalition partners bombing in Iraq. In fact, pretty much everybody is. But I think I'm right in saying only the United States and Canada in Syria. Is it time for everyone to realise that that's a fairly academic distinction at this point?
It is quite academic at the moment, particularly in military terms, because the fighters go backwards and forwards across this notional border pretty often, and they are the same group. Yes, I think the international community would have to look quite carefully at the legal framework, but they probably would be wise not to be too academic about it. Otherwise, they're going to be hampered in their attacks on IS.
On the subject of legal framework, and I'll put this boat to both of you, to you first, Jane, we're getting to the stage at which Islamic State now controls more than 50% of Syrian territory. It controls a significant stretch of Syria's borders. At what point is Islamic State, for all that it is what it is, actually starting to look more like the state of Syria than Syria does?
Well, you still have Bashar Assad in control of territory where most of Syria's population is, which is important. Islamic State is still a minority group. So I think it's probably early to start treating it as some kind of replacement government. The other issue, of course, is that even in the Syrian opposition, Islamic State is a minority. So in Syria, you have at the very least a three-pronged conflict. You've had quite significant gains just a couple of weeks ago by other parts of the Syrian opposition, also Islamists, but of a slightly different flavour, who managed to take the city of Idlib.
Michael, how strange is it, or how difficult does it become, or how more difficult does it become the more Islamic State begins to take on more of the aspects of an actually recognisable sovereign entity?
Well, different countries have different criteria for recognising governments. Some recognise governments entirely on a political basis. So some would say we're never going to recognise Islamic State, even if they control 99% of the territory and of the population. Other countries, including Britain, have a much more pragmatic recognition measurement, and they don't say, is it a good government or a bad government? They just say, is it effectively in control of the country? Well, that's very far from the case at the moment. It's in control of quite a lot of territory, but as Jane said, it's certainly not in control of the majority of the population. So I think there's a long way to go before any country recognises IS as the government, unless it's some other ideological campaign, such as Boko Haram or someone, who are effectively allies of IS in any case.
Jane, you mentioned their Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, who for a short period a few months ago was actually being quite chatty, giving breezy interviews to invited Western journalists, etc., etc., etc. In the last few weeks, he seems to have gone surprisingly quiet for a man theoretically still leading a country at war. Is there any reason we can think of why that might be the case?
Well, he's under pressure on multiple fronts, obviously with the loss of territory to Islamic State and to the Islamic Front part of the Syrian opposition. I think there are also some question marks about the extent to which he's still receiving such solid economic and military support from Iran, because Iran is itself quite stretched trying to fight Islamic State in Iraq. The Syrian pound has been weakening, and there's been various reports that seem to point to some divisions within the regime. So he probably has quite a lot to keep him busy other than sitting around pontificating to Foreign Policy magazine.
And I think there's another very crucial element to this, and that is that Kerry, the Secretary of State for the US, was talking to Putin in Russia last week, and there are a lot of reports that they were talking about dropping Russian support for Assad. The Russians have made it quite clear that if there's an alternative to Assad, who is equally committed to keeping the Russian naval presence in Tartus on the coast and to upholding treaties with Russia, they wouldn't object to seeing Assad go. And I think the Russians can make it pretty tough for Assad, even if they start squeezing him a small amount over arms supplies. So if they're getting a bit nervous about their unlimited support for him, then he certainly ought to be getting nervous himself.
Jane, another subtext, I guess, of Islamic State's conquests in the last week of Ramadi in Iraq and Palmyra in Syria has been, there's a kind of defiance there of what appears to be, or at least what appears in my inexpert view, to be military logic, which is that they are a lightly armed, irregular army trying to conquer and hold vast stretches of desert with not very much cover, yet their opponents have a 21st century air force. This shouldn't be possible, should it?
Well, airstrikes are famously poor at tackling insurgent groups. You're seeing a very similar thing going on in Yemen, where the Saudi Arabians have one of the best financed air forces in the world, but haven't been able to force the Houthi militia, inexperienced as it is, to retreat, because ultimately it's difficult to target these groups from the sky, especially when they're very fluid, and Islamic State seem to be able to move around very rapidly, sort of reassemble, go to different places. So, in fact, the thing that the Syrian regime has found most effective in combating them has been other militias and paramilitary forces, even more than the regular Syrian army, because it's a different kind of warfare.
Michael, President Barack Obama described the seizure of Ramadi as a tactical setback, which is a pleasing addition to the collection of euphemisms for defeat. Do you get the sense, or do we in general get the sense, that there is, in the kind of collective wisdom of the Western world, a theoretical tipping point at which it becomes clear that whether we like it or not, and I'm sure we don't like it, wider involvement on the ground is feasible? I mean, the outer suburbs of Damascus, a bit of Baghdad, how far do Islamic State, or how far are they allowed to go before the world decides, actually, okay, that we'll have to do?
It's a very good question. It's possibly also, how cruel do they have to be before the world takes action? If they start systematically blowing up Palmyra, which I think they will do, because it will cause a fury and a sensation around the world, and the irony here is that this will probably cause much more outrage than if they killed lots of people.
Indeed,
people worry about ruins much more than they worry about human beings. And a famous ruin like Palmyra, if they start dynamiting it, I think there will be a great call for, let's do something about these guys. I think they'll have to go quite far before the West gets drawn into further military engagement, and certainly before it gets drawn into boots on the ground. I think the Americans have more or less put an absolute ultimatum, an absolute veto on any involvement, come what may. You may say that, yes, surely at some point we have to stop them, we being the West. I'm not sure that will happen.
Jane, are there other more regional powers who could or should take more of a role, whether it is Iran, who obviously already are participating, but also Turkey and Saudi Arabia, you would think would have a vested interest in not letting this get too far out of hand?
They do, but Iran and Saudi Arabia have very different, in fact, utterly polarised views on the best way to fight Islamic State. Although they both want to fight it, Iran thinks the best way to fight it is to back the regime. Saudi Arabia thinks that it is to back an alternative opposition, also quite Islamist, also in some cases brutal, but fundamentally not as anti-Western and anti-Saudi as Islamic State is.
Okay, well, we will doubtless come back to this subject pretty much ad infinitum. I don't think it's going away anywhere soon. We should look a little closer to home. 2 weeks ago today, if I've done my maths right, that is right. 2 weeks ago today, Britain was waking to an almost entirely unexpected election result, which was the return of David Cameron's Conservative Party with their own clear majority. One consequence of this is that it has committed the returned Prime Minister to something he might have hoped he'd be able to avoid, a referendum on the UK's membership of the EU. And at an EU summit in Riga, he started pitching for the better deal that he hopes to be able to sell to the British people, because he has so far been at pains to say that he would campaign for a yes, the UK should stay vote. Michael, is it possible to tell what exactly David Cameron wants?
He wants something that looks as though it's a concession by Europe, but in fact that he can assure his partners doesn't need a treaty change, because he's been told by lots of people, especially the French recently, that changing the treaty is simply not on the table. If Britain gets a change just to benefit Britain, every other member of the European Union will also want to renegotiate this or that or some particular aspect of the treaty that would be to their benefit if it was changed, and that would more or less overnight unpick the entire treaty, or treaties, there are several of them. So he does want something visible. And the easiest thing probably would be something to do with freedom of movement. Now, it's going to be very difficult to ban this outright, because it's a pillar of the European Union that there's freedom of movement as well as freedom of trade and freedom of cross-border exchanges. But something to either limit the number of immigrants going across in seeking work elsewhere, or to limit the obligation of a country to pay them benefits when they come. That would be the most important thing for those people in Britain who are most opposed to the EU treaty. We're going to see big business campaigning very strongly to set us to stay in, but we're also going to see a lot of ordinary people still worried about immigration, which is the big issue.
Because, Jane, that is how it strikes me, at least, that shorn of all the other flannel and things that people keep trying to pretend are associated issues, where Britain is concerned and where the British people are concerned, this is basically just about immigration, isn't it?
That was one of the dominant issues in the election campaign here, of course, spearheaded by the UK Independence Party. But even the Labour Party was making mugs that said controls on immigration. It had become such a populist...
Well, they were making mugs with that written on them, but not actually introducing any policies that might bring that about, because this was the weird thing about that debate, because as everybody knows full well, short of making some drastic accommodation with the EU, there is actually nothing anybody can do about immigration, at least not from within the EU.
Another interesting element of it is that it's a completely different debate in Scotland, where the party that won, the SNP, wants more immigration. That's part of Britain where, for most of its existence, Scotland has sent migrants to the rest of the world rather than receiving them, and they would quite like to have more Europeans come and work in Scotland. So if we do see Britain deciding to leave the EU, that's the main thing that could trigger another referendum in Scotland.
Michael, do you get the sense that the rest... Because I'm always struck by the difference in attitudes to the EU that you see across the EU. In most of the continent, with no exception I can think of, it's regarded as a fact of life. In Eastern Europe, in the new arrivals to the EU in particular, it is adored. It is a thrill. They fly the EU flag alongside their own national flags almost as of reflex. Do those countries understand the depths of British ambivalence about the European Union?
Well, some of the older members of the EU certainly do, and France is a key one. And France is, like Britain, very conscious of its own identity and sovereignty, and is quite jealous of its sovereignty. And although France has benefited enormously from the EU, and therefore it has seen the EU in a way as an adjunct to French foreign policy, they do now feel, actually, it's Germany that runs the EU and not France. And they're beginning to fret about regulation from Brussels. And in fact, the Marine Le Pen, the leader of the National Front, is strongly suspicious and indeed sceptical of the European Union and has a large number of votes. Other countries, the Netherlands, which you would have thought would be absolutely the heart of the EU, they too are pretty sceptical. They too don't like Brussels issuing what have seemed to be decrees without popular democratic backing. Eastern Europe, as you say, is in the state of still adoring the EU, but that's because it is seen as a way of protecting themselves from the old bad past and the bright, shining future. But big countries that have histories of their own, particularly Poland, they may soon become a bit more sceptical than they are now.
Jane, do you think that, I mean, surely from David Cameron's point of view, the ideal scenario for him is that he's able to secure some sort of opt-out for the UK on freedom of movement, because that would at one fell swoop give him something he can sell to the British people, and it would destroy UKIP as well, because that's their only issue. Is that a plausible ambition for him?
He does have some bargaining power because of the referendum. And it's interesting that the EU doesn't want any member state to leave. And so the threat of exit actually becomes quite a useful tool. You see in Greece also being able to use this to quite strong effect, despite being such a relatively small country. But there are issues that go beyond immigration as well. A lot of the issues that come up in the press when people are criticising the EU are to do with bureaucracy, red tape, and ultimately a deficit of democracy. Perhaps it's not the same for Eastern European countries who have seen the EU help democratise them as it is in older democracies which feel that they are ceding some sovereignty to powers that aren't that transparent and aren't very familiar or connected to the people here.
And Michael, is there, I'm just sort of thinking out loud here, but is it not actually a more realistic, perhaps, relationship for Britain to have with the EU, a sort of semi-detached one? Because the other thing that just always strikes me as an outsider to Britain and obviously to the European Union is that the British, they don't, it's not even that they dislike the EU, they don't care. I couldn't name my own MEP with a gun at my head, and I don't actually think very many people in this country could. It does sort of seem either an irrelevance or an irritation.
It does indeed. And of course, this is a typical insular mentality. Britain is an island, and it thinks like an island, and it doesn't feel itself part of the heartland of Europe. Even though there is now a physical connection through the tunnel and lots of people come and go and all that, you're right. People are indifferent to Europe. They're pretty ignorant about it as well. They don't really know what goes on. And there is this perception that Britain loses billions and billions of pounds every year in paying to the EU and vastly subsidising other parts of the EU. Actually, what people don't realise is that Britain receives billions and billions of pounds or euros or whatever for regional development and other issues for Britain. People just are unaware of that. They don't really care. They've always historically had the attitude of balance of power. Let the continentals fight it out as long as nobody becomes top dog. And Britain then can look overseas to, you know, friends elsewhere, the Commonwealth, America, whatever, the wider ocean. And a bit of that mentality still remains.
Okay, well, on that note, we are going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Jane Kinnamont and Michael Binion. Coming up next, Ireland's vote today on same-sex marriage.
It was designed by a suspect bohemian, houses a coup plotter, and today is favoured by young liberal creatives. Madrid's Edificio Princesa is a concrete testament to the contradictions of Spain's transition to democracy, as our correspondent Liam Aldis discovered.
Today, the building that was once dubbed the bunker by Madrileños is now seen in a very different light, as plant life has progressively engulfed the structure, fulfilling the architect's original vision and providing residents with plenty of verdant balconies. Edificio Princesa is being celebrated as a model of inner city, high density architecture that has withstood the test of time.
On the home front, a photographic portrait now playing in the film section at monocle.com.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jane Kinnenmont from Chatham House, Michael Binion from The Times. Late breaking news pertaining to our most recent discussion. David Cameron has admitted that his early efforts to renegotiate Britain's relationship with Brussels today were not met with a wall of love. I think that's one of your great British understatements. We will look slightly closer to home. It is a weirdly common dynamic, at least it occurs to me, of all modern struggles for civil rights, that when resistance to progress does collapse, it tends to do so completely and quickly. It's only 22 years since the Republic of Ireland decriminalised homosexuality, and today the country could become the first in the world to legalise same-sex marriage by popular vote. A referendum is taking place on marriage equality today. Opinion polls, with all due respect to the recent mishap on that front in this country, are confident of a yes. I was struck reading about this by a quote from the 70-year-old Irish Senator David Norris, who said, "It's extraordinary to have once been considered a criminal, and now I might be able to marry if anyone would have me," that is. Jane, has Ireland really changed that much that quickly, or is this just the law catching up with people?
The extent of social change has been phenomenal since the Second World War in terms of the economic development, the education, the cosmopolitan nature of Ireland. Again, like Scotland, it's a country that used to send people elsewhere and had almost no migrants, only colonial people coming to the country. It's now a much more varied and cosmopolitan place. So it is possible that this change could happen today.
Michael, huge progress has been made on this particular issue of gay equality, same-sex marriage in across the Western world, at least, very suddenly over the last 10 or 20 years. Why has it accelerated so quickly? I mean, it isn't just Ireland. Well within my lifetime, homosexuality was illegal in this country and indeed in my own homeland, which is rather dragging the chain where same-sex marriage is concerned, I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit. But why has it happened so fast?
I think because the prophecies of doom, of social collapse, of widespread immorality and all those things that traditionalists forecast haven't happened.
But it's always the way with civil rights, isn't it? It's just like if we allow women to vote or black and white people, yes, to get married, then civilization will collapse. And
absolutely.
And that never happens.
Well, I think there's a particularly important factor in Ireland, and that is the huge, huge collapse in authority of the Roman Catholic Church. Because the Roman Catholic Church had a position of moral authority in Ireland, which was way, way bigger and stronger and more influential than perhaps in almost any other country, including Italy. And I'm afraid that the recent stories, the scandals, the reports of widespread child abuse and things of this kind, and particularly of convents where young women were locked up and frankly made to work as slave labour in many parts of Ireland, have so shocked the younger generation that because the Catholic Church has taken a strong position against same-sex marriage, a lot of younger people have thought, let's just stick it to the Catholic Church. And that is one of the reasons that they are so convinced by this sudden switch, because it's a way of saying to the Catholic Church, you don't rule this country anymore.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of people are reported to have been flying home or catching the ferry home just to vote yes, although it is, of course, a bank holiday weekend this weekend, which may, there may be a slight overlap in motivation there. Jane, as you mentioned the Scottish referendum earlier. What do you think of the idea of a referendum in this case over a matter of conscience, if you will?
It's an interesting one. It is an example of direct democracy. And, of course, many people think that democracy should have its limits in some cases, especially when it comes to certain issues of human rights or civil rights at the same time. This is going to be an issue that is divisive in society. It cannot be said that it's a universal human right when social attitudes have changed so dramatically. I can see why they think that it's worth actually not just having a politician make this decision, but see what society thinks is acceptable.
Because where do you stop with this, Michael? Because it just occurs to me that in this country, again, if opinion polls are correct, if a referendum was conducted tomorrow here on the reintroduction of capital punishment, the British people would vote quite enthusiastically to bring back the rope, to the mortification, doubtless, of the political establishment. What is a fair thing to put to the people's vote and what isn't?
Well, it's generally, certainly the case in Britain, is that they don't put anything that is not a primary issue affecting the constitution of the United Kingdom. We've hardly ever had referendums. We had one recently to do with the voting system. That is very much a constitutional issue. And the reason is that most people in Britain say we don't want to be like Switzerland, where we have referendums every two or three weeks on all kinds of issues, and we have a kind of unpredictable outcome and more or less a chaotic democracy. And anyway, Switzerland is much smaller, so it's much easier. The probably rule of thumb is that the only time we might contemplate a referendum is on issues where Parliament itself has a free vote. In other words, an issue which, as Jane says, is much more to do with moral and social issues rather than political or financial. And this clearly is a moral and social issue. But even then, I think in Britain, we would be very reluctant to have a referendum because people would say, well, if you have one on this, why don't you have one on that or on this or all kinds of things? And then you would actually have a completely, given the size of Britain, you would have a pretty unworkable democracy.
We will finish this evening with a look at television in the Czech Republic, which is not something we discuss often, but these are exceptional times. It is almost certain that in the early days of the reality television age, some satirical japester rolled their eyes and suggested that someday someone would set some dubious historical conceit amid a recreation of Nazism. Just as inevitably, this has now happened. Czech viewers will presently be treated to Holiday in the Protectorate, in which a modern family will relive in heavily inverted commas the German occupation of Bohemia and Moravia. Jane, I don't even know. I mean, the producers are making the inevitable noises about how it's educational, etc., etc. I mean, really, is it?
It could be one of the most tasteless things known to man. But who knows? I think there are... I mean, for one thing, the memory of what happened needs to be kept alive for a new generation in some way. And a lot of books, a lot of museums try to take approaches to the Holocaust and that period of history, which puts the viewer or the visitor in the first person, in the perspective of someone who was living it. So I'm going to take a leap of faith and say this is fantastic.
See, I'm sceptical about this because I don't think you can really put somebody's not really in that position if they know that they're basically being yelled at by unemployable actors dressed as Nazis and at the end of it they can go home.
Well, that's exactly the point. Everybody knows it's not real. It's not the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia. It's modern day Czech Republic. And you're not going to have yourself dragged out suddenly and sent to a camp or shot or tortured or whatever if you say the wrong thing. So the atmosphere of fear is entirely either acted or unrealistic or non-existent, or the whole basis of a thing is simply farcical.
I mean, they're also saying, Jane, that, and again, I'm going to put this to you as the resident optimist, that they're hoping it will promote discussion. But again, my question is, what discussion is there? Are there people saying, you know, the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, was it all bad? I mean, this we know what we think about the Nazi occupation of Europe, don't we?
Do the younger generation people definitely have this awareness? Are they reading the books? Are they reading Anne Frank's diary? Have they got that sense of history that people of our generation might have from their parents or their grandparents? I don't know. I think it would be incredibly difficult to do well, but I think it is potentially an invitation to use your imagination. Of course, it's not real.
We'll invite you to come back and let us know what you made of it after you've digested the first few episodes. We will now have to leave it there. Jane Kinnan-Mont and Michael Binion, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sara Moneta. Our studio manager was Sean Malervi. For the next half hour after this, you'll be able to listen to Tom Edwards with Monocle's International Playlist on the Atlantic Shift. At 1900 hours, Marcus Hippie is here with The Menu. At 2200, Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds are here with The Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at 1800. Monday. I think I'm hosting that one as well. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.